43.
When she first woke up, she was still in her Radicea's coverall, mummified in gaffer's tape, lying on the floor of a shitty old Ford van blasting across the middle of nowhere. This did not put her in a very favorable mood. The stun bunny left her with a persistent nosebleed and an eternal throbbing headache, and every time the van hit a chuck hole, her head bounced on the corrugated steel floor. First, she was just pissed. Then she started having brief moments of fear, wanting to go home. After 8 hours in the back of the van, there was no doubt in her mind that she wanted to go home. The only thing that kept her from giving up was curiosity. As far as she could tell from this admittedly poor vantage point, this didn't look like a Fed operation. The van pulled off the highway onto a frontage road and into a parking lot. The rear doors of the van opened up and a couple of women climbed in. Through the open doors, YT could see the Gothic arch logo of a Reverend Wayne's pearly gates.
"Oh, you poor baby,"
one of the women said. The other woman just gasped in horror at her condition. One of them just cradled her head and stroked her hair, letting her sip sweet Kool-Aid from a Dixie cup, while the other tenderly, slowly took the gaffer's tape off. Her shoes had already been removed when she woke up in the back of the van, and no one offered her another pair. And everything had been removed from her coverall. All the good stuff was gone. But they hadn't gone underneath the coverall. She still had the dog tags. And one other thing. A thing between her legs called a dentata. There's no way they could have found that. She has always known that the dog tags were probably a fake thing anyway. Uncle Enzo doesn't just go around giving his war souvenirs to 15-year-old chicks, but they still might have an effect on someone. The two women are named Marla and Bonnie. They are with her all the time. Not only with her, but touching her. Lots of hugs, squeezes, hand-holding, and tousled hair. The first time she goes to the bathroom, Bonnie goes with her, opening the stall door and actually standing in there with her. YT thinks that Bonnie is worried that she's going to pass out on the toilet or something. But the next time she has to pee, Marla goes with her. She gets no privacy at all. The only problem is, she can't deny that she likes it in a way. The ride in the van hurt. It really hurt bad. She never felt so lonely in her life. And now she's barefoot and defenseless in an unfamiliar place, and they're giving her what she needs. After she had a few minutes to freshen up, whatever that means, inside the Reverend Wayne's pearly gates, she and Marla and Bonnie climbed into a big stretch van with no windows. The floor was carpeted, but there were no seats inside. Everyone sat on the floor. The van was jammed when they opened the rear doors. 20 people were packed into it, all energetic, beaming youths. It looked impossible. YT shrank away from it, backing right into Marla and Bonnie. But a cheerful roar came up from the van people, white teeth flashing in the dimness, and people began to scrunch out a tiny space for them. She spent most of the next 2 days packed into the van between Bonnie and Marla, holding hands with them constantly, so she couldn't even pick her nose without permission. They sang happy songs until her brain turned to tapioca. They played wacky games. A couple of times every hour, someone in the van would start to babble, just like the Falabellas, just like the Reverend Wayne's Pearly Gates people. The babbling would spread throughout the van like a contagious disease, and soon everyone would be doing it. Everyone except for YT. She couldn't seem to get the hang of it. It just seemed embarrassingly stupid to her, so she just faked it. 3 times a day they had a chance to eat and eliminate. It always happened in burbclaves. YT could feel them pulling off the interstate, finding their way down twisty development lanes, courts, ways, and circles. A garage door would rise electrically. The van would pull in, the door would shut behind them. They would go into a suburban house, except stripped of furniture and other family touches, and sit on the floor in empty bedrooms, one for boys, one for girls, and eat cake and cookies. This always happened in a totally empty room in a house, but there was always different decor. In one place, flowery, countryish wallpaper and a lingering smell of rancid glade. In another, bluish wallpaper featuring hockey players, football players, basketball players. In another, just plain white walls with old crayon marks on them. Sitting in these empty rooms, YT would study the old furniture scrapes on the floors, the dents in the sheetrock, and muse over them like an archaeologist wondering about the long-departed families who had once lived here. But toward the end of the ride, she wasn't paying attention anymore. In the van, she could hear nothing but singing and chanting, see nothing but the jammed-together faces of her companions. When they stopped for gas, they did it in giant truck stops out in the middle of nowhere, pulling up to the most distant pump island so that no one was near them. And they never stopped driving. They just got relayed from one driver to the next. Finally, they got to a coast. YT could smell it. They spent a few minutes waiting, engine idling, and then the van bumped over some kind of a threshold, climbed a few ramps, stopped, set its parking brake. The driver got out and left them all alone in the van for the first time. YT felt glad that the trip was over. Then everything started to rumble, like an engine noise, but a lot bigger. She didn't feel any movement until a few minutes later when she realized that everything was rocking gently. The van was parked on a ship, and the ship was headed out to sea. It's a real ocean-going ship, an old, shitty, rusty one that probably cost about $5 at the ship junkyard. But it carries cars, and it goes through the water, and it doesn't sink. The ship is just like the van, except bigger, with more people. But they eat the same stuff, sing the same songs, and sleep just as rarely as ever. By now, YT finds it perversely comforting. She knows that she's with a lot of other people like her, and that she's safe. She knows the routine. She knows where she belongs. And so finally they come to the raft. No one has told YT this is where they're going, but by now it's obvious. She ought to be scared, but they wouldn't be going to the raft if it was as bad as everyone says. When it starts coming into view, she half expects them to converge on her with gaffer's tape again. But then she figures out it's not necessary. She hasn't been causing trouble. She's been accepted here. They trust her. It gives her a feeling of pride, in a way. And she won't cause trouble on the raft because all she can do is escape from their part of it onto the raft per se. As such, the real raft. The raft of 100 Hong Kong B-movies and blood-soaked Nipponese comic books. It doesn't take much imagination to think of what happens to lone 15-year-old blonde American girls on the raft, and these people know it. Sometimes she worries about her mother. Then she hardens her heart and thinks maybe the whole thing will be good for her. Shake her up a little. Which is what she needs. After Dad left, she just folded up into herself like an origami bird thrown into a fire. There is kind of an outer cloud of small boats surrounding the raft for a distance of a few miles. Almost all of them are fishing boats. Some of them carry men with guns, but they don't fuck around with this ferry. The ferry swings through this outer zone, making a broad turn, finally zeroing in on a white neighborhood on one flank of the raft. Literally white. All the boats here are clean and new. There's a couple of big rusty boats with Russian lettering on the side, and the ferry pulls up alongside one of them. Ropes are thrown across, then augmented with nets, gangplanks, webs of old discarded tires. This raft thing does not look like good skating territory at all. She wonders if any of the other people on board this ferry are skaters. Doesn't seem likely. Really, they are not her kind of people at all. She has always been a dirty scumdog of the highways, not one of these happy sing-along types. Maybe the raft is just the place for her. They take her down into one of the Russian ships and give her the grossest job of all time, cutting up fish. She does not want a job, has not asked for one, but that's what she gets. Still, no one really talks to her. No one bothers to explain anything, and that makes her reluctant to ask. She has just run into a massive cultural shockwave, because most of the people on this ship are old and fat and Russian and don't speak English. For a couple of days, she spends a lot of time sleeping on the job, being prodded awake by the hefty Russian dames who work in this place. She also does some eating. Some of the fish that comes through this place looks pretty rank, but there's a fair amount of salmon. The only way she knows this is from having sushi at the mall. Salmon is the orange-red stuff. So she makes some sushi of her own, munches down on some fresh salmon meat, and it's good. It clears her head a little. Once she gets over the shock of it and settles into a routine, she starts looking around her, watching the other fish-cutting dames, and realizes that this is just like life must be for about 99% of the people in the world. You're in this place. There's other people all around you, but they don't understand you, and you don't understand them, but people do a lot of pointless babbling anyway. In order to stay alive, you have to spend all day, every day, doing stupid, meaningless work. And the only way to get out of it is to quit, cut loose, take a flyer, and go off into the wicked world where you will be swallowed up and never heard from again. She's not especially good at cutting up fish. The big, stout Russian chicks, stomping, slab-faced babushkas, keep giving her a hassle. They keep hovering, watching her cut with this look on their face like they can't believe what a dork she is. Then they try to show her how to do it the right way, but she's still not so good at it. It's hard, and her hands are cold and stiff all the time. After a couple of frustrating days, they give her a new job, farther down the production line. They turn her into a cafeteria dame, like one of the slop slingers in the high school lunchroom. She works in the galley of one of the big Russian ships, hauling vats of cooked fish stew out to the buffet line, ladling it out into bowls, shoving it across the counter at an unending line consisting of religious fanatics, and more religious fanatics. Except this time around, there seems to be a lot more Asians and hardly any Americans at all. They have a new species here, too. People with antennas coming out of their heads. The antennas look like the ones on cop walkie-talkies, short, blunt, black rubber whips. They rise up from behind the ear. The first time she sees one of these people, she figures it must be some kind of new Walkman, and she wants to ask the guy where he got it, what he's listening to. But he's a strange guy, stranger than all of the others, with a permanent thousand-yard stare and a bad case of the mumbles, and he ends up giving her the creep so bad that she just shoves an extra-large dose of stew in his face and hurries him on down the line. From time to time, she actually recognizes one of the people who are in the van. But they don't seem to recognize her. They just look right through her, glassy-eyed, like they've been brainwashed, like YT was brainwashed. She can't believe it has taken her this long to figure out what they were doing to her. And that just makes her more pissed. In reality, Port Sherman is a surprisingly tiny little burg, really just a few square blocks. Until the raft came along, it had a full-time population of a couple of thousand people. Now the population must be pushing 50,000. Hero has to slow down a little bit here, because the refuse are all sleeping on the street for the time being, an impediment to traffic. That's okay. It saves his life. Because shortly after he gets into Port Sherman, the wheels on his motorcycle lock up, the spokes become rigid, and the ride gets very bumpy. A couple of seconds after that, the entire bike goes dead, becomes an inert chunk of metal. Not even the engine works. He looks down into the flat screen on top of the fuel tank, wanting to get a status report, but it's just showing snow. The BIOS has crashed. Asheraz possessed his bike. So he abandons it in the middle of the street, starts walking toward the waterfront. Behind him, he can hear the refuse waking up, struggling out of their blankets and sleeping bags, converging over the fallen bike trying to be the first to claim it. He can hear a deep thumping in his chest, and for a minute, he remembers Raven's motorcycle in L.A., how he felt it first and heard it later. But there are no motorcycles around here. The sound is coming from above. It's a chopper, the kind that flies. Hiro can smell the seaweed rotting on the beach. He's so close. He comes around a corner and finds himself on the waterfront street, looking straight into the facade of the Spectrum 2000. On the other side is water. The chopper's coming up the fjord, following it inland from the open sea, headed straight for the Spectrum 2000. It's a small one, an agile number with a lot of glass. Hiro can see the crosses painted all over it where the red stars used to be. It is brilliant and dazzling in the cool blue light of early morning because it's shedding a trail of stars, blue-white magnesium flares, tumbling out of it every few seconds, landing in the water below, where they continue to burn, leaving an astral pathway marked out down the length of the harbor. They aren't there to look cool. They are there to confuse heat-seeking missiles. From where he's standing, he can't see the roof of the hotel because he's looking straight up at it. But he has the feeling that Gurov must be waiting there, on top of the tallest building in Port Sherman, waiting for a dawn evacuation to carry him away into the porcelain sky, carry him away to the raft. Question: why is he being evacuated? And why are they worried about heat-seeking missiles? Hiro realizes, belatedly, that some heavy shit is going on. If he still had the bike, he could ride it right up the fire stairs and find out what's happening. But he doesn't have the bike. A deep thump sounds from the roof of a building on his right. It's an old building, one of the original pioneer structures from 100 years ago. Hiro's knees buckle, his mouth comes open, shoulders hunch involuntarily. He looks toward the sound, and something catches his eye. Something small and dark, darting away from the building and up into the air like a sparrow. But when it's 100 yards out over the water, the sparrow catches fire, coughs out a great cloud of sticky yellow smoke, turns into a white fireball, and springs forward. It keeps getting faster and faster, tearing down the center of the harbor until it passes all the way through the little chopper, in through the windshield and out the back. The chopper turns into a cloud of flame, shedding dark bits of scrap metal like a phoenix breaking out of its shell. Apparently, Hiro's not the only guy in town who hates Gurov. Now Gurov has to come downstairs and get on a boat. The lobby of the Spectrum 2000 is an armed camp full of beards with guns. They're still putting their defense together. More soldiers are dragging themselves out of their coin lockers, pulling on their jackets, grabbing their guns. A swarthy guy, probably a totter sergeant left over from the Red Army, is running around the lobby in a modified Soviet Marine's uniform, screaming at people, shoving them this way and that. Gurov may be a holy man, but he can't walk on water. He'll have to come out to the waterfront street, make his way 2 blocks down to the gate that admits him to the secured pier, and get on board the Kodiak Queen, which is waiting for him, black smoke starting to cough out of its stacks, lights starting to come on. Just down the pier from the Kodiak Queen is the Kowloon, which is the big Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong boat. Hiro turns his back on the Spectrum 2000 and starts running up and down the waterfront streets, scanning the logos until he sees the one he wants, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong. They don't want to let him in. He flashes his passport. The doors open. The guard is Chinese, but speaks a bit of English. This is a measure of how weird things are in Port Sherman. They have a guard on the door. Usually, Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong is an open country, always looking for new citizens, even if they are the poorest refuse.
"Sorry," the guard says in a reedy, insincere voice. "I did not know."
He points to Hiro's passport. The Franchulet is literally a breath of fresh air. It doesn't have that third-world ambiance, doesn't smell like urine at all. Which means it must be the local headquarters, or close to it, because most of Hong Kong's Port Sherman real estate probably consists of nothing more than a gunman hogging a payphone in a lobby. But this place is spacious, clean, and nice. A few hundred refuse stare at him through the windows, held at bay, not by the mere plate glass, but by the eloquent promise of the three rat-thing hutches lined up against one wall. From the looks of it, two of those have just been moved in recently. Pays to beef up your security when the raft is coming through. Hero proceeds to the counter. A man is talking on the phone in Cantonese, which means that he is, in fact, shouting. Hero recognizes him as the Port Sherman proconsul. He is deeply involved in this little chat, but he has definitely noticed Hero's swords, is watching him carefully.
"We are very busy," the man says, hanging up.
"Now you are a lot busier," Hero says. "I would like to charter your boat, the Kowloon."
"It's very expensive," the man says.
"I just threw away a brand new top-of-the-line motorcycle in the middle of the street because I didn't feel like pushing it half a block to the garage," Hero says. "I am on an expense account that would blow your mind."
"It's broken."
"I appreciate your politeness in not wanting to come out and just say no," Hero says. "But I happen to know that it is, in fact, not broken, and so I must consider your refusal equivalent to a no."
"It's not available," the man says. "Someone else is using it."
"It has not yet left the pier," Hero says. "So you can cancel that engagement using one of the excuses you have just given me, and then I will pay you more money."
"We cannot do this," the man says.
"Then I will go out into the street and inform the refuse that the Kowloon is leaving for L.A. in exactly 1 hour, and that they have enough room to take 20 refuse along with them. First come, first serve," Hero says.
"No,"
the man says. "I will tell them to contact you personally."
"Where did you want to go on the Kowloon?"
the man says. "The raft."
"Oh, well, why didn't you say so?"
the man says.
"That's where our other passenger's going."
"You've got someone else who wants to go to the raft?"
"That's what I said. Your passport, please."
Hero hands it over. The man shoves it into a slot. Hero's name, personal data, and mugshots are digitally transferred into the Franchlet's BIOS. And with a little bit of key pounding, the man persuades it to spit out a laminated photo ID card.
"You get onto the pier with this," he says. "It's good for 6 hours. You make your own deal with the other passenger. After that, I never want to see you again."
"What if I need more consular services?"
"I can always go out and tell people," the man says, "that a nigger with swords is out raping Chinese refugees."
This isn't exactly the best service I've ever had at a Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong.
"This is not a normal situation," the man says. "Look out the window, asshole."
Not much has apparently changed down at the waterfront. The Orthos have organized their defense in the lobby of the Spectrum 2000. Furniture has been overturned, barricades set up. Inside the hotel itself, Hero presumes furious activity is going on. It's still not clear whom the Orthos are defending themselves against. Making his way through the waterfront area, Hero doesn't see much. Just more Chinese refuse in baggy clothes. It's just that some of them look a lot more alert than others. They have a whole different effect. Most of the Chinese have their eyes on the mud in front of their feet and their minds on something else. But some of them are just strolling up and down the street, looking all around, alertly. And most of these people happen to be young men wearing bulky jackets and haircuts that are from a whole other stylistic universe than what the others are sporting. There is evidence of styling gel. The entrance to the rich people's pier is sandbagged, barbed wired, and guarded. Hero approaches slowly, his hands in plain sight, and shows his pass to the head guard, who is the only white person Hero has seen in Port Sherman. And that gets him onto the pier. Just like that. Like the Hong Kong Franchulet, it's empty, quiet, and doesn't stink. It bobs up and down gently on the tide, in a way that Hero finds relaxing. It's really just a train of rafts. Plank platforms built over floating hunks of styrofoam. And if it weren't guarded, it would probably end up getting dragged out and lashed onto the raft. Unlike a normal marina, it's not quiet and isolated. Usually, people moor their boats, lock them up, and leave. Here, at least one person is hanging out on each boat, drinking coffee, keeping their weapons in plain sight, watching Hiro very intently as he strolls up the pier. Every few seconds, the pier thunders with footsteps, and one or two Russians run past Hiro, making for the Kodiak Queen. They are all young men, all sailor-soldier types, and they're diving onto the Kodiak Queen as if it's the last boat out of hell, being shouted at by officers running to their stations, frantically attending to their sailor chores. Things are a lot calmer on the Kowloon. It's guarded, too, but most of the people appear to be waiters and stewards, wearing snappy uniforms with brass buttons and white gloves. Uniforms that are intended to be used indoors, in pleasant, climate-controlled dining rooms. A few crew members are visible from place to place, their black hair slicked back, clad in dark windbreakers, to protect them from the cold and spray. Hiro can only see one man on the Kowloon who appears to be a passenger, a tall, slender Caucasian in a dark suit, strolling around, chatting into a portable telephone. Probably some industry jerk who wants to go out for a day cruise, look at the refuse on the raft while he's sitting in a dining room having a gourmet dinner. Hiro's about halfway down the pier when all hell breaks loose on shore in front of the Spectrum 2000. It starts with a long series of heavy machine gun bursts that don't appear to do much damage, but do clear the street pretty fast. 99% of the refuse just evaporate. The others, the young men Hiro noticed, pull interesting high-tech weapons out of their jackets and disappear into doorways and buildings. Hiro picks up the pace a little, starts walking backward down the pier, trying to get some of the larger vessels in between him and the action, so he doesn't get hit by a stray burst. A fresh breeze comes off the water and down the pier. Passing by the Kowloon, it picks up the smell of bacon frying and coffee brewing, and Hiro can't help but meditate on the fact that his last meal was half of a cheap beer and a Kelly's tap in a snoozing cruise. The scene in front of the Spectrum 2000 has devolved into a generalized roar of unbelievably loud white noise as all the people inside and outside of the hotel fire their weapons back and forth across the street. Something touches his shoulder. Hiro turns to brush it away, sees that he's looking down at a short Chinese waitress who has come down the pier from the Kowloon. Having gotten his attention, she puts her hands back where they were originally, to wit, plastered over her ears.
"You Hiro protagonist?"
she mouths, basically inaudible over the ridiculous noise of the firefight. Hiro nods. She nods back, steps away from him, jerks her head toward the Kowloon. With her hands plastered over her ears this way, it looks like some kind of a folk dance move. Hiro follows her down the pier. Maybe they're going to let him charter the Kowloon after all. She ushers him onto the aluminum gangplank. As he's walking across it, he looks up to one of the higher decks, where a couple of the crew members are hanging out in their dark windbreakers. One of them is leaning against a railing, watching the firefight through binoculars. Another one, an older one, approaches him, leans over to examine his back, slaps him a couple of times between the shoulder blades. The guy drops his binoculars to see who's pounding him on the back. His eyes are not Chinese. The older guy says something to him, gestures at his throat. He's not Chinese either. The binocular guy nods, reaches up with one hand, and presses a lapel switch. The next time he turns around, a word is written across his back in neon green electropigment. Mafia. The older guy turns away. His windbreaker says the same thing. Hiro turns around in the middle of the gangplank. There are 20 crew members in plain sight all around him. Suddenly, their black windbreakers all say, "Mafia." Suddenly, they are all armed. I was planning to get in touch with Mr. Lee's Greater Hong Kong and file a complaint about their proconsul here in Port Sherman, Hiro jokes. He was very uncooperative this morning when I insisted on renting this boat out from under you. Hiro is sitting in the first-class dining room of the Kowloon. On the other side of the white linen tablecloth is the man Hiro had previously pegged as the industry creep on vacation. He's impeccably dressed in a black suit, and he has a glass eye. He is not bothered to introduce himself, as though he's expecting Hiro to know who he is already. The man does not seem amused by Hiro's story. He seems rather nonplussed.
So?
Don't see any reason to file a complaint now, Hiro says.
Why not?
Well, because now I understand his reluctance not to displace you guys.
How come? You got money, don't you?
Yeah, but...
Ah,
the man with the glass eye says, and allows himself sort of a forced smile.
Because we're the Mafia, you're saying.
Yeah, Hiro says, feeling his face get hot. Nothing like making a total dickhead out of yourself. Nothing in the world like it. No siree, Bob. Outside, the gun battle is just a dim roar. This dining room is insulated from noise, water, wind, and hot flying lead by a double layer of remarkably thick glass, and the space between the panes is full of something cool and gelatinous. The roar does not seem as steady as it used to be.
Fucking machine guns, the man says. I hate 'em.
Maybe 1 out of 1,000 rounds actually hit something worth hitting, and they kill my ears.
You want some coffee or something?
That'd be great.
We got a big buffet coming up soon. Bacon, eggs, fresh fruit you wouldn't believe.
The guy that Hiro saw earlier up on the deck, pounding binocular man on the back, sticks his head into the room.
Excuse me, boss, but we're moving into, like, the third phase of our plan. Just thought you'd want to know. Thank you, Livio.
Let me know when the Ivans make it to the pier.
The guy sips his coffee, notices Hiro looking confused.
See, we got a plan, and the plan is divided up into different phases.
Yeah, I got that.
The first phase was immobilization, taking out their chopper. Then we had phase two, which is making them think we were trying to kill them in the hotel. I think that this phase succeeded wonderfully.
Me too.
Thank you. Another important part of this phase was getting your ass in here, which is also done.
I'm part of this plan? The man with the glass eye smiles crisply.
If you were not part of this plan, you would be dead.
So you knew I was coming to Port Sherman?
You know that chick YT? The one you have been using to spy on us?
Yeah. No point in denying it.
Well, we have been using her to spy on you.
Why? Why the hell do you care about me?
That would be a tangent from our main conversation, which is about all the phases of the plan.
Okay. We just finished phase two.
Now, in phase three, which is ongoing, we allow them to think that they are making an incredible heroic escape, running down the street toward the pier.
Phase four!
Shouts Livio, the lieutenant.
Scusi,
the man with the glass eye says, scooting his chair back, folding his napkin back onto the table. He gets up and walks out of the dining room. Hiro follows him above deck. A couple of dozen Russians are all trying to force their way through the gate onto the pier. Only a few of them can get through at once, and so they end up strung out over a couple of 100 feet, all running toward the safety of the Kodiak Queen. But a dozen or so manage to stay together in a clump, a group of soldiers forming a human shield around a smaller cluster of men in the center.
Bigwigs, the man with the glass eye says, shaking his head philosophically.
They all run crab-like down the pier, bent down as far as they can go, firing the occasional covering burst of machine gun fire back into Port Sherman. The man with the glass eye is squinting against a cool sudden breeze. He turns to Hiro with a hint of a grin.
Check this out, he says, and presses a button on a little black box in his hand.
The explosion is like a single drumbeat coming from everywhere at once. Hiro can feel it coming up out of the water, shaking his feet. There's no big flame or cloud of smoke, but there is a sort of twin geyser effect that shoots out from underneath the Kodiak Queen, sending jets of white, steamy water upward like unfolding wings. The wings collapse in a sudden downpour, and then the Kodiak Queen seems shockingly low in the water, low and getting lower. All the men who are running down the pier suddenly stop in their tracks.
"Now,"
Binocular Man mumbles into his lapel. There are some smaller explosions down on the pier. The entire pier buckles and writhes like a snake in the water. One segment in particular, the segment with the bigwigs on it, is rocking and seesawing violently, smoke rising from both ends. It has been blown loose from the rest of the pier. All of its occupants fall down in the same direction as it jerks sideways and begins to move, yanked out of its place. Hiro can see the tow cable rising up out of the water as it is stretched tight, running a couple of hundred feet to a small open boat with a big motor on it, which is now pulling out of the harbor. There's still a dozen bodyguards on the segment. One of them sizes up the situation, aims his AK-47 across the water at the boat that's towing them, and loses his brains. There's a sniper on the top deck of the Kowloon. All the other bodyguards throw their guns into the water.
"Time for phase five," the man with the glass eye says. "A big fucking breakfast."
By the time he and Hiro have sat back down in the dining room, the Kowloon has pulled away from the pier and is headed down the fjord, following a course parallel to the smaller boat that is towing the segment. As they eat, they can look out the window across a few hundred yards of open water and see the segment keeping pace with them. All the bigwigs and the bodyguards are on their asses now, keeping their centers of gravity low as the segment bucks nastily.
"When we get farther away from land, the waves get bigger," the man with the glass eye says.
"I hate that shit. All I want is to hang on to the breakfast long enough to tamp it down with some lunch."
"Amen,"
says Livio, heaping some scrambled eggs onto his plate.
"Are you going to pick those guys up?" Hiro says. "Or just let them stay out there for a while?"
"Fuck 'em. Let 'em freeze their asses off. Then when we bring them onto this boat, they'll be ready for it. Won't put up too much of a fight. Hey, maybe they'll even talk to us."
Everyone seems pretty hungry. For a while, they just dig into breakfast. After a while, the man with the glass eye breaks the ice by announcing how great the food is, and everyone agrees. Hiro figures it's okay to talk now.
"I was wondering why you guys were interested in me."
Hiro figures that this is always a good thing to know in the case of the Mafia.
"We're all in the same happy gang,"
the man with the glass eye says.
"Which gang is that?"
"Lagos's gang."
"Huh?"
"Well, it's not really his gang, but he's the guy who put it together. The nucleus around which it formed."
"How and why and what are you talking about?"
"Okay."
He shoves his plate away from him, folds up his napkin, puts it on the table.
"Lagos had all these ideas. Ideas about all kinds of stuff."
"So I noticed."
"He had stacks all over the place on all different topics. Stacks where he would pull together knowledge from all over the fucking map and tie it all together. He had these things stashed here and there around the metaverse, waiting for the information to become useful."
"More than one of them?" Hiro says.
"Supposedly. Well, a few years ago, Lagos approached L. Bob Reif."
"He did?"
"Yeah. See, Reif has a million programmers working for him. He was paranoid that they were stealing his data."
"I know that he was bugging their houses and so on."
"The reason you know that is because you found it in Lagos' stack. And the reason Lagos bothered to look it up is because he was doing market research, looking for someone who might pay him hard cash for the stuff he dug up in the Babylon Focalypse stack."
"He thought," Hiro says, "that L. Bob Reif might have a use for some viruses."
"Right. See, I don't understand all this shit. But I guess he found an old virus or something that was aimed at the elite thinkers."
"The technological priesthood," Hiro says. "The infocrats. It wiped out the whole infocracy of Sumer."
"Whatever."
"That's crazy," Hiro says. That's like if you find out your employees are stealing ballpoint pens, you take them out and kill them. He wouldn't be able to use it without destroying all his programmers' minds.
In its original form, the man with the glass eye says. But the whole point is, Lagos wanted to do research on it.
Informational warfare research.
Bingo. He wanted to isolate this thing and modify it so it could be used to control the programmers without blowing their brains sky high.
And did it work? Who knows?
Reif stole Lagos's idea. Just took it and ran with it. And after that, Lagos had no idea what Reif did with it. But a couple of years later, he started getting worried about a lot of stuff he was seeing.
Like the explosive growth in Reverend Wayne's pearly gates.
And these Ruskies who speak in tongues. And the fact that Reif was digging up this old city.
Eridu.
Yeah. And the radio astronomy thing. Lagos had a lot of stuff he was worried about. So he began to approach people.
He approached us.